I've been working during the last 2 years on this book entitled Paradis Fiscaux, la filière canadienne. And it's a book on the way historically Canadians shaped tax havens in the Caribbean. The book is so made that there are 12 chapters. Each chapter is about a date, a specific jurisdiction, a Canadian player, and a specific problem. And each time we see since 1889 that there were, involving Canadians, tax havens that appeared in the world with respect to specific Canadian players being in the middle of problems related to tax havens. When we talk about tax havens, usually we think about, of course, the tax issue, but it's not the only one. Tax havens are also related to the secrecy of activities that occur in countries where the disclosure of information is very hard to obtain. We find maybe 80 or 90 of them. And if there are so many, it's because every tax haven has its own specialty, its own expertise. I mean, they all have their specific offers. If investors want to register ships, they'll go in Liberia or in Panama. If in the insurance company, major players wish to deal with the capital they have without any kind of constraint, they'll go to the Bermudas or the Turk and Caicos Islands, because there it's the haven of the insurance companies. If it's about the the intellectual property rights, in Ireland, it's possible to register assets with respect to that kind of income without paying any tax. For German taxpayers, to avoid taxation, it's better to go to the Liechtenstein, because it's made in order to help German taxpayers to avoid taxation. It's the same with Monaco and Switzerland with respect to Frenchmen. Or I'll talk about that, or the Barbados to Canadians. So tax havens allow wealthy people, corporations, to avoid taxation, to circumvent a lot of social and legal constraint, and to operate worldwide in these specific jurisdictions without any substantial law. And it costs populations a lot. And I'll give three reasons for that. First of all, billion and billion of dollars each year leave the country in order to avoid taxation. And since billion and billion of dollars are leaving the country because wealthy people and corporations and financial institutions are able in a legal manner to use tax havens because of the loopholes the governments made available to them, well, our countries, our democratic countries, our legal states, our traditional states, behave as being in competition with tax havens. So they start to reduce the taxes on the income of corporations. For instance, in our country, in 1981, on the federal level, the federal tax on the income of corporations was about 38%, and now it's 15%. And I'm not talking about all kind of taxes concerning the capital that disappeared or were reduced. So we lose money because money leaves. We lose money on the second hand because we don't tax the corporations as we used to do, because we want to attract the capital or keep it here. So, and it's the third problem, to allow governments to finance their public services and public institutions, we borrow money. So we borrow money to institutions that we don't tax anymore. Mm-hmm. So we lose on all those levels. And what I was interested in doing these researches with all my colleagues was to understand why at the origin of these tax havens that put all countries in the world in competition one against the other to attract capital. Canadians were at the origin of those countries. In the 50s and 60s, Canadians were pioneers of the Caribbean tax havens that are well known, like the Bahamas, the Cayman Islands, the Barbados, Jamaica, and other countries. What I could say right away is that in 1956, the first ever governor of the Canadian Bank, Graham Towers, after his career, became the counselor of the Jamaican government to help the Jamaican government to shape new laws with respect to the banking sector. And in this year, 1956, everything changed in Jamaica. And everything changed in order to attract capital while promising tax breaks. The international business companies were created that year so that investors that would create entities in Jamaica without having any real activity on the island could have tax breaks and then avoid taxation at home. So a Canadian shaped that. And it didn't work too well because in that time in Jamaica there was an independentist movement that neutralized the process. Then Canadians tried the same thing in the Bahamas. Why? At that time, two reasons explain why we specifically then aim to transform former colonies or actual current colonies into tax havens. First of all, after the Second World War, Americans invest billions of dollars in Europe. It was the Marshall Plan to help the countries that were destroyed by the war to rebuild their public infrastructures. And these dollars were circulating in a free manner, regardless which bankers or countries were using them. It was the first time that bankers could deal with so much American bills, regardless of the fact that usually they were dealing with their own currency. In the tax havens, in these small islands of the British Empire, it was clear that it was an opportunity to attract this capital, to use it without any kind of constraint, because it wasn't regulated by any kind of authority. So you had all these euro dollars, these so-called euro dollars that appear on the world market and that could be managed in tax havens, in countries that were shaped at that time to allow industrials, investors, banks, multinationals to deal with this capital without any kind of constraints. And at that time, also, the organized crime in the US started to understand, since Al Capone was caught on a fiscal issue by a law court, that it was important to deal with this issue outside the US. So in Switzerland and in Cuba, the organized crime started to organize a whole system to launder money. And in Cuba, it was casinos that were created and used to launder money until 1959, when the Cuban Revolution made it necessary to move to the Bahamas. And then in the Bahamas, Canadian banks and players were there to shape the jurisdiction so that it was possible to launder money. For instance, the Minister of Finance and Tourism at that time in the Bahamas in the middle 1960s, Sir Stafford Sands, who was responsible of the finance, but also tourism meant casinos, hotels, and all that kind of activities. He was minister of its jurisdiction and a member of the board of the Royal Bank of Canada. So he could, during the day, shape his jurisdiction so that it fit with the interest of the bank he was managing the night, in the evening. And the Scotia Bank that was already active on the island, on this series of islands, was very active in counseling the government, so it gives itself a new tax law with
banking secrecy
and all those elements. And this counselor that worked for the Scotiabank was the former Minister of Finance of Diefenbaker, namely Donald Fleming. So the former Minister of Finance of Canada was counseling the government of the Bahamas to help the jurisdiction to shape itself into a tax haven to attract the capital that was coming from Europe, these dollars that weren't controlled by any kind of authority, and also on the other hand, the money provided by the American organized crime. And the Scotiabank and the Royal Bank of Canada were also involved in different kind of project related to these casinos and hotels that were built to help the organized crime to launder money. And it was mentioned in a lot of U.S. reports from the White House or the Chamber of Representatives law authorities. And I could talk about also the role of Jim McDonald, a lawyer from Calgary, who helped the Cayman authorities, the Cayman Islands authorities, to do the same as in the Bahamas, when the Bahamas were targeted by the IRS, the U.S. fiscal authorities, because it seemed very clear that money laundering was occurring in the Bahamas, and to help some players to move their assets in the Cayman Islands, then arrived Jim McDonald, who created a law firm called McDonald and Maples, and then with a partner, John Maples, who then was called Maples and Calder, and then Maples. And this law firm was not only specialized in the delocalization of assets in tax havens, but in the creation of tax havens as such. And the Cayman Islands are in the middle of the financial crisis of 2008, because a lot of hedge funds are located there and play in a very risky manner with our own earnings on the stock markets. And in the 1980s, Canada, the Canadian government, made it possible for Canadian multinationals to register assets in the Barbados and to transfer back the funds that multinational could register in the Barbados in Canada without paying any tax. It was this agreement against double taxation. It was done as if Canadian government thought that when multinationals from here register assets in the Barbados and bring them back here, they had already paid tax in the Barbados, although the tax rate is about 1%. So, and that's how Canadians happen to shape tax havens in this precise context of the second half of the 20th century.
Is that the Liberal government or
regardless, I mean, they are all involved.
But in 1980, it was.
In 1980, it was under Joe Clark.
Yeah,
during its short term, but it was never. I mean, the Liberals afterward, in the Trudeau era or Paul Martin era, didn't work against that agreement. And what is interesting to consider, and Catherine Brown worked on that, is that if Canadians were in the position to create those tax havens, it's because they were already there since decades. And it's just interesting to see that Canadians were there since decades, because Canada already in the 19th century behaved in certain ways like a haven before we even had this concept, being very permissive for the banking sector,